Oceans cover about 70% of our planet and hold 95% of our biosphere, that is, places where life can thrive. We humans can relate easily to some marine species, especially whales, dolphins, and seals, you know, mammals who breathe air like we do. But befriending and learning from creatures with gills and without backbones is an unusual pastime for humans, unless you are Craig Foster. Diving virtually every day for years into the nearshore waters of South Africa with just a mask, snorkel, and flippers, Craig eventually became friends with an octopus and told the story in his 2020 Academy Award-winning documentary, My Octopus Teacher. Craig Foster's daily practice of diving in the shallow waters of the great African sea forest has yielded some fascinating insights into the lives of creatures living there. With friend and diving partner Ross Freilink, he wrote the 2021 book Underwater Wild, My Octopus Teacher's Extraordinary World. The movie itself is compelling, and this book is even more amazing, if that's possible, as it tells the stories of the kelp forest with stunning photographs and gripping prose. Craig joined me from Cape Town for Living on Earth Book Club event, and I started by asking him to describe where he dives in this underwater world just offshore.
The Great African Sea Forest stretches from right up Namibia all along the west coast of South Africa and then turns around the point and goes a few hundred kilometers up the east coast. So it's about 1,400 kilometers in length. And the actual kelp itself grows to up to 15 meters or 45 feet in length. So it feels like you're in a giant swaying underwater forest, especially if the water is clear. It's one of the greatest sights on Earth. And the top is, you know, they're heavy leaves that come off the blade. So you get shafts of light coming through the holes in the leaves. And it's this kind of magical dance of light. The enormous number of animals in the kelp, living on the kelp itself, on the holdfast, in the leaves, and then a great biodiversity of animals living, you know, around the forest itself.
So you get into this forest by doing something that I think most of us would think is torture. The water is not exactly warm there, even in December. I suspect it's probably not above, what, 60 degrees Fahrenheit? Maybe it's not even 50 degrees Fahrenheit yet. But you swim without a wetsuit. Why do you do this? And you do offer an explanation in your book. So I want you to tell me about your ideas regarding brown fat.
Yeah, so I mean, I grew up, you know, very close to the ocean, so close that the waves used to, you know, break parts of our house down. So I grew up diving from 3 years old, and we never had wetsuits in those days. So I had, you know, my first 10 years of life doing that. And I had I always in the back of my mind knew that this cold was something special. And whenever I had a difficult time, I used to go back into that cold water. And then about 10 years ago, I just decided I'm going to try and dive, you know, every day for a decade. And I didn't want to wear the wetsuit because I wanted to try and adapt my body to the cold and see how that affected me. And what it does is, it gives you this incredible lift. There's a big shift in brain chemistry, an enormous amount of dopamine introduced to the brain. The cortisol levels drop radically. So you feel much calmer and you feel uplifted. So it's this wonderful feeling. And also your mind somehow works better. So I do a lot of underwater tracking, and you need to have your mind really engaged. So the cold, ironically, actually helps with that tracking. And you ask about the brown fat. So every baby is born ready for the wild environment. We are wild-born creatures. So it's born with a brown fat, which are little pockets that act as thermoregulation devices. They heat the body when it's cold. And if we don't expose ourselves to cold, what happens is this brown fat kind of withers and doesn't become useful. But if you expose yourself over and over again to cold, the brown fat builds up. And sometimes, you know, if you're really feeling good and healthy, because a lot of other parameters have to be in place, you know, you can be in this cold water here and really starting to get quite cold. And then suddenly you just feel this heat being released by the body. It's an incredible feeling. It's almost ecstatic. and you can feel yourself warming up in that cold, and you can keep going. So it's an amazing device that's part of our evolutionary makeup. It's almost like having an inbuilt cloak, a warm coat, but inside your body that just turns on and keeps you comfortable.
I gather, though, that this doesn't happen exactly the first time you go in cold water. How long did it take you to develop your brown fat and this remarkable reaction to the cold?
So what I could feel was, after about a year of going every day, quite a big difference, stopping shivering after each dive. And then it just seems to increase over the next sort of 2 or 3 years gradually. And then, of course, another big factor with the cold is it seems to improve your immune system dramatically. I used to get, ill with flus and colds and things pretty regularly. And I can't remember when I last had a flu or cold or anything like that. So it really does make a massive difference to the immune system.
Well, certainly it's very convenient right now in this time of COVID and the stresses that we see around the world, including South Africa, to have that ability. So, of course, we're having this discussion with you, Craig, because of your documentary, My Octopus Teachers. And you know, one of the most remarkable moments in that film is when she actually extends her arm, a tentacle, and touches your hand. Why do you suppose a wild animal would make contact with a human in this way?
Yeah, it's really strange. It's not easy to answer that in many ways. It's totally mysterious. Not a lot, but quite a few animals will sometimes decide to reach out and make contact with a human. In the case of octopus or cephalopods, they have a natural curiosity. So their whole lives are balanced between this fear and curiosity. And they're almost like a cat. You know how curious cats are. They just can't help themselves. And when she's putting that one arm out like that, she's also, all her other arms are attached very strongly to the den. So she wants to know, she wants to feel, she wants to taste, because they, they can taste with the suckers as well. But she's being very careful. She's putting the one arm out, and she just can't help herself. What is this strange creature here? What does this thing smell like, taste like? And they it's curiosity. It's sheer curiosity.
Craig, here in Boston at the New England Aquarium, I also got to meet an octopus, courtesy of naturalist Cy Montgomery, named Octavia, I think, and she was in a tank, not in the open ocean. And she also extended one of her arms to hug my right arm, and I felt so connected to her. And then I was heartbroken when I learned that she would only live a year. Why such a short life, do you think?
Yes, I had the privilege of speaking to Cy not very long ago, and read her wonderful book. It's quite interesting. You think, these octopus only live for such a short time. I think there was a giant Pacific octopus, am I right, Octavia? So I think they live for up to 4 or 5 years, but the smaller octopus, like my octopus teacher, only live for a year and a half. And you think, oh my goodness, they're dying and they're so clever, this can't be good. But it's actually an incredible strategy, especially in the difficult world we're facing now with the environmental crisis, because animals like cephalopods that can breed very fast, they live fast and die young kind of thing, actually much more resilient than animals, say, like sharks, like the pajama shark, for instance, grows very slowly. They get up to 35 years old. They mature late, and they're much more vulnerable than cephalopods. So it's actually a very good strategy for survival, and they're one of the animals that do relatively well, even under all the pressures we're throwing at them.
And in your book, by the way, you introduce us to another cephalopod in the kelp forest there, the cuttlefish. And you were lucky enough to witness an incredible display of how cuttlefish have mastered the art of mimicry. This is something you describe on page 159 of your book, but I suspect you can tell us about it from memory.
Yeah, I never can forget. That's the wonderful thing about learning directly from these animals, Steve. It's so powerful, and you get impacted so heavily that you can never forget a lot of the detail. And I remember very clearly the first day that I saw a tuberculate cuttlefish. This is a small species of cuttlefish that only occurs in South Africa. And they are such masters of camouflage that when I looked at this creature, I had no idea what it was. I thought maybe it's a strange piece of algae or what the hell's going on here, and was mimicking the algae. And this animal then changed into a cuttlefish and jetted off and left a puff of ink in front of my face. And I was just like open-mouthed, gobsmacked. And this animal is even better at camouflage than an octopus, if you can imagine that. It's very small, very vulnerable, soft-bodied. So it's got this incredible way of pretending to be a hard-shelled whelk. It changes its whole body shape and it points its arms and it changes its color, and even tiny details of these little polychaete worms that grow on the backs of the whelk shells, it even mimics those. So it fools predators into thinking it's a hard shell. It even then sometimes pretends to be a hermit crab living in that hard shell and drags itself along slowly where it can actually swim, you know, relatively fast. And then if it has to swim, it can actually mimic a fish called a clipfis that lives in this environment. So this animal is truly the master of mimicry and camouflage. It's quite incredible.
One of the most enticing aspects of your book is the sense that there's much more that's going on in the kelp forest, and indeed in nature, than just simply one creature finding its prey, that it's just sort of a rough and tumble and difficult and challenging world. You found a lot of cooperation and understanding and affiliation under the seas there, much of which hasn't been documented before. Talk to us a bit about that.
What I found was there were such unusual alliances. And one of the most interesting alliances was between the tuberculate cuttlefish that we've just spoken about and one of my favorite fish, which is called the giant clingfish or rock sucker. And what was incredible is that when these fish are adult, they could so easily predate or eat the small cuttlefish. I mean, it's absolutely a perfect snack for them. And the other way around as well, an adult cuttlefish would, you know, quite easily eat the young fish. And in fact, they do eat a lot of fish in the environment. But for some reason, which I think I may have worked out, they have formed this ancient alliance where they completely leave each other alone and don't predate each other's babies. And you'll see them sitting, you know, right together like friends in these little caves. It's quite remarkable, but it's clever because they both benefit tremendously from this alliance. And it's been forged over an enormous period of time in this environment. So, and I think, you know, this whole idea of, you know, nature being a kind of environment where it's just, you know, everything's killing everything else. Certainly, there are a lot of predators, for instance, in the kelp forest. And I see a lot of predations and kills going on every day. But one thing I've also learned is, like, if you look at the bigger picture, that the whole biodiversity is in this incredible balance. So, for instance, you know, the pajama shark is predating the octopus, but it also keeps those octopus numbers in balance, because if it didn't do that, those octopuses would overwhelm a lot of the mollusks and you'd have a, you know, shortage of food and everyone would suffer, including the octopus. So it's incredible how the biodiversity and this whole living system and this natural intelligence is kind of looking after itself in this wonderful way and looking after us as well.
I found it as a reminder of my responsibility as a human to not just simply be extracting from nature, but to do my role, to help the other creatures as they help me. We have a question now from a student at the Boston Community Leadership Academy. It's called the McCormick School. It's for grade 7 to 12. And just down the street from our studios at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. So let me ask my producer, Jenny Doering, if she could roll that tape for us.
Hi, my name is Jill, and I'm from the BCLA McCormick. My question is, What is the most amazing thing that you learned while exploring the kelp forest?
Lovely question. Thank you. You know, I learned a great deal from my octopus teacher. I learned so much about her behavior and her species behavior. I learned, you know, I was able to find new species thanks to her actually living in her den, an incredible form of mysid that shoals inside the octopus dens. So a lot of incredible behavior. So I have many animal teachers, not only the octopus, specialized fish that surf out of the water, 2 meters out of the water to get their prey, the limpets, and twist them off the rock. So an extraordinary teaching in animal behavior that can, you know, straight from those animals. But I guess the most powerful thing that I think I learned was that all the animals in the kelp forest, and in fact, all the animals and plants in the ocean and on this planet, make up what we call biodiversity. And this biodiversity has tremendous intelligence, and it is the immune system of our planet. And I realized and I felt, like actually felt in my heart, how this natural system has kept us alive for 300,000 years. That's how long we've been on this planet as a species. It's kept us alive since the very beginning of time. It kept our great-great-great-grandfathers and grandmothers alive. And over time, it's just kept us alive, and it's still keeping us alive today. Every single breath we take, every mouthful of food, it's all thanks to this great natural system. And it's so important to remember that and do everything we can to help the system and to regenerate her, because she's our mother. She is our mother of every single human that's ever been on this planet.
We continue now with the story of when Ross and Craig encountered a great white shark.
It actually just occurred just off here where I'm sitting now, only a few hundred meters from where I'm sitting. And we were swimming out, maybe 300 or 400 meters out, and we were with a friend. And Ross, who's my friend and co-author, we were a bit ahead. And suddenly we turned around because our friend was shouting, and he'd just seen a huge great white swim past. And he could see the fear and sort of shock in his eyes. And it was sort of circling around towards us. And I mean, it is, you know, if you are not used to sharks, they've been through Jaws and all the, you know, media and so on, have been blown up into these, like, you know, terrifying creatures that are just after humans and will kill you. And it's really quite the opposite. I had been fortunate enough to spend 2 years diving with sharks, making a film about great whites and tiger sharks and other sharks. So I was quite used to being with sharks, and I knew that, you know, first of all, they didn't see humans as food. We don't come up on their radar as food. And it's actually quite hard to get close to them. So I was excited that he'd seen this shark, and I wanted to stay and wait for this wonderful encounter. It's a real privilege, and it's pretty difficult to see a great white in the wild. They're not very common, and they stay away from humans generally. So the others were a bit horrified that I wanted to wait, but we were in a safe position. We had a big rock behind us, and we were on a shallowish shelf. And one of the things is that you don't want that great white coming underneath you and doing a vertical approach on you in murky water. So we were in there's all these protocols when working with these big sharks. So we were actually in a very safe place. And we waited, but unfortunately that animal, like mostly happens, it wasn't too interested, even perhaps a little bit afraid of these strange creatures, and it moved away. But it was a little bit frightening for the others who weren't, you know, hadn't had the privilege of knowing these animals. And Ross has subsequently, you know, got to know sharks much better, and now would, you know, not be afraid in a circumstance like that.
Yeah, I mean, how close did the great white come to Ross?
I think it came within 3 or 4 meters, swam past, and just cruising along, no aggression whatsoever. But I mean, you see an animal like that it's a large animal that can weigh up to, you know, over a ton. So it's a large, intimidating shark.
Because your close encounters weren't all with creatures with fins and gills and the ability to stay endlessly underwater. You had truly remarkable experience with an otter while swimming one day. Perhaps you could tell us about that now.
Yeah, these animals are really special. It's a Cape clawless otter. So they live on land in holts, in little holes in the rocks and under grasses and things. And then they hunt in the kelp forest every day, but they're extremely shy. I mean, people can be living here for quite a few years and, you know, never having seen one. I mean, you've visited many times here, I know, Steve. Have you seen one of these otters?
I certainly haven't. No, and I've even walked among those rocks where you have pictures of their of where they go, and I've never noticed one.
Yeah, so it's not an animal that you see often. And you might normally see it from a distance. So I was diving very early in the morning. I think it was winter, pretty freezing cold. And I was like, what am I doing so early here? What's going on? And then I just, out of the corner of my eye, I saw this big creature that I think the third biggest otter in the world. It's like a medium-sized dog, like bouncing off the bottom of the ocean. They go down and they bounce off. And all the tiny bubbles come out their fur. And I was, wow, this is, you know, so lucky just to get a glimpse of this Cape clawless otter underwater in the kelp forest. It was so exciting. And I just kept my body very, very still. I didn't move a muscle. And then I was amazed to see this otter curious, like you said, what's going on here? Now coming in closer to me, and I could sense it was a bit afraid, but also very curious. And then it approached. But it approached from behind. So it's thinking, okay, I mustn't get anywhere near this strange creature's mouth. I'm going to approach from behind and see what happens. I just kept dead still. And then I just felt its incredible little hands. They've got hands not unlike human hands, feeling my feet. And it was absolutely extraordinary. I was just on fire. I forgot about the cold, everything. It was just unbelievable. And then it slowly moved up my body, and then it came right in front of my face, and I stared into that wild face of that Cape clawless otter, and it put its little hands out and started touching my face, and it was just almost too much. I was overwhelmed, absolutely overwhelmed. And then it played with me in the water for maybe 10 minutes. And it was almost too much for me, the experience. It was so overwhelming. I got out and sat on a rock, and then the animal approached again. Very strange, mysterious encounter. It's hard to know why they do this, but it perhaps could be that early humans were hunting cooperatively with these animals. And there's still a few places in the world, I believe in Bangladesh, where humans and otters hunt cooperatively, and maybe somehow, I mean, it's mysterious. This is a big maybe. This animal was kind of remembering some of this evolutionary past and wanted to engage again with this process. Or maybe it was just very curious and bold and wanted to see what I was and realized, because it's a very intelligent animal, that I wasn't a threat.
There's another question back to the octopus. Natalie Arias, who's in the eighth grade, asks, how have you used what you've learned from the octopus and the experience in your personal life?
Yeah, that's quite a difficult question in a way. What it did, initially that comes to mind is when you start having relationships with wild animals and a lot of wild animals, it takes a lot of pressure, strangely enough, off your human relationships. You know, we rely very heavily on human relationships for our well-being. But as you start having the relationships with these wild animals and spending time with them, and I like sometimes spending time alone with them, you kind of feel that it's a wonderful feeling, the pressure off the human relationships. And that is a very positive thing, because you're not so needy anymore. but you just want that relationship with that human because you love them, you care for them, and it's not so much you need them. And I think it's something to do with, you know, since if we go back in time, and I'm very fascinated with human origins, and I'm fascinated with living wild and how sophisticated early humans were. And I think that it's a natural state. It's, we used to, and we're expecting to have relationships with multiple animals in our environment. So the psyche is expecting that. And when we don't have that, we put more weight on our human relationships, and that can sometimes be a bit difficult. So that's one of the things that I guess I've got a lot out of that, is I've have this relationship with these wild animals, and it's improved, I think, my human relationships.
So to what extent does the ocean heal you? I mean, you and your co-author, Ross, mentioned in this volume that you've been recovering from emotionally traumatic experiences you've had. You talk about divorce. Ross mentions a difficult relationship with his father. So how has the ocean healed you?
I think in a number of ways. As I say, the daily immersion, almost anybody can be in not a very good mood or quite tired, lethargic. And I promise you, I'll take you into that water. And 20 minutes later, you're going to feel completely different. It almost works for everybody. And that's because there is actually a big brain chemistry shift and a physiological shift. And that can last for many hours of the day. And then, of course, having a relationship with wild animals changes one dramatically. You feel connected to your environment. You know their behaviors. You have a sense of place. You don't feel so separate a lot of the time. You know, so separate, you feel like you are connected to an environment. And that psychologically is very empowering. And it also gives you purpose and meaning, because you, the more you know, the more interesting it is. I mean, I just can't wait to get back every day to see what's happening. I've got 20 or 30 mysteries I'm working on. Will I be able to get a little bit further with solving them? Taking photographs, I'm writing down the notes, interacting with a whole group of incredible marine biologists who are fascinated with this world. It's an empowering way of living, and you kind of fall in love with wild nature. And I think this is something that humans have done for a very long time. So you feel kind of a little bit in the human design. You feel like you are doing maybe what you're designed to do, and that feels good. But it's not like this perfect elixir that, you know, you just go and do that and then everything's fine. Of course, there's, you know, a lot of things come along, life's difficulties, but it's also incredible to have the tool of the ocean. If I'm struggling, I force myself to go down there and I force myself in that cold water, and I can normally get out of that difficult space because it has this way of affecting one quite dramatically.
Craig, speaking of difficult spaces, places, as a species, we're in trouble. Just look at the ocean. I mean, between climate change, plastic pollution, changing the ocean chemistry to make it more acidic, we're making things difficult for ourselves and for the creatures that are there. How do you think getting closer to the oceans might help us reverse this decline in the way we humans are treating this environment that supports us? I mean, should we all just get in the water and take a look?
I think we should. I mean, but, you know, it's also doesn't have to be the water. If you are far away from the water, you know, your backyard, there are insects. Or if you're even in a city, they're actually, in most cities, they're incredible animals. The biggest, I think, threat in many ways to our environment is this disconnection, or what I call the cooling of the human heart to nature, is in my mind the greatest threat. And if we don't know creatures and plants and fungi and algae and all these wonderful things, it's hard to care for them. It's hard to make decisions in life to regenerate or benefit nature. So the act of connection is an extraordinary act in empowering oneself and others to think about system change, to think about ways to regenerate this biodiversity, which is the very lifeblood of ourselves and our planet. And it doesn't matter where you are or what animals or plants or living forms you get to know, it's just making that connection again. Because when you've made the connection, you definitely start thinking and caring about that thing you start to love.
Well, it's very attractive. I mean, one might say that you're advocating a quiet reverence, like Jane Goodall, who sat and sat and sat until finally one of those primates was able to approach her, to make the connection the way that you made the connection with your octopus and otter. And so to what extent is the prescription for healing our planet one of patient waiting and expectation, waiting and seeing how nature approaches us as opposed to us trying to thrust our way out into nature?
That's a wonderful way, I think, to put it, Steve. And I can hear it comes from you having thought a lot about this. Nature is so much more sophisticated than us. We think our technology is so sophisticated, but it's, you know, it's so slow and pathetic compared to the technology of nature. I mean, what she can do at ambient temperature, we couldn't even think about doing with our technology. It's quite extraordinary. So she has all the answers. She knows what to do. We new on this planet, we the new babies on the block. So we need to really listen to her and watch her, because I think we can learn so much from her. So I love that. I love what you're saying, that idea.
Craig Foster is a co-founder of what he calls the Sea Change Project and co-author of Underwater Wild, My Octopus Teacher's Extraordinary World. Thank you so much for joining us today, Craig. What a gift.
Thanks so much, Steve.